a little bit of a different way to open Political Rewind on this President's Day. I'm Bill Nygut, and we're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting, as we always do. But that song, throughout the show today, we're going to play songs from musicals that have some reference to or about are about presidents of the United States. That particular song is from a show that Leonard Bernstein wrote in 1976, called 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It's about the White House and the occupants of the White House. The lyric is, "Take care of this house, keep it from harm. Care for this house, shine it by hand, and keep it so clean the glow can be seen all over the land, for this house is the home of us all." The show ran for 7 performances and closed, but this song does, in fact, continue to pop up every now and then. So on this President's Day, we'll play some music from Broadway shows that relate to presidents. Jim Galloway, of course, the political writer for the AJC, is here with us. You read his column on Thursdays and Sundays. He had a great column yesterday, Jim, that we'll talk about, Sally Yates.
Now, if you're public enemy number one, can I be public enemy number two?
Yes, that's right.
Take a number.
That's probably right, yeah. And we'll talk, too, about that at some point in this show. Liz Flowers is back with us. You know, she is the director of the Democratic Caucus in the state legislature in the Senate. And you were gone for a while. You went off to New York and realized that it was so much better to be back home in the South. Yes,
I love it here with you all. You know I do.
All right. Well, Liz, we're glad to have you back. And Todd Rehm, the GOP political consultant and also the editor of that great daily blog, GeorgiaPundit.com, where you can get all sorts of fascinating news about what's going on in politics nationally across the state and in local communities. Glad to have you here today, Todd, as well.
Thanks for having me back.
Sure. Later in the show, we will talk about presidents. We're going to be joined by the co-author of a really interesting piece that appeared in the Washington Post that's based on a study of political scientists surveyed to say who are the best presidents and the worst presidents. It's an annual survey. It's changed just a little bit, and we'll talk about that later in the show. But, Jim, let's start with state news. You this morning, the AJC had a fascinating front-page story, or an important front-page story, about the fact that there seems to be two very different movements going on down at the Capitol. One among kind of the rebellious members, like a Josh McCoon, who want to get past the traditional media and want to open up the committee meetings to sunshine. He started bringing a video, his camera in, and feeding out committee meeting
via Periscope. And this is it really is interesting. The whole world is online, except for the Senate committee system, and it is purposely kept offline, so you actually have to show up to individual meetings to find out what's going on.
Yeah, I think McCoon is quoted in the article, which Christina Torres, your colleague, wrote, says that he can go online and look at Columbus City Council meetings from a year ago, but he can't find his own committee meetings.
Right, and now the state house in the same building has got itself wired, so you can tune into any House committee meeting from afar and watch the whole proceedings.
Yeah, I mean, Todd, Georgia Public Broadcasting, of course, broadcasts the sessions every day and has access to the wiring that Jim's referring to, and there'd be no reason why we couldn't broadcast those things, at least put them on the web, if nothing else. Is it smart for Senate leaders particularly to be pushing back on this, what appears to be an effort to stop transparency?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily smart to interfere with citizens who are there with their cameras in the front row, not getting in anybody's way.
Which is what happened last week.
And I think, frankly, if you don't want a whole lot of audience for this, what you want to see is 17 different people with cameras, all with their own small segment of the audience. And eventually, it'll just become as boring as it really is in life, and people will stop paying attention to it. But when you start harassing the folks with the cameras, You make it more dramatic. It becomes a stand on principle. I think part of it is about resources and the staff time it would take to cover anywhere from 3 to 6 committee meetings in different rooms at different times. And the both houses of the General Assembly are probably 15 years behind the times in terms of internal technology because they don't want to be seen as spending money on themselves.
Liz, the AJC piece today quotes a Woodstock resident named Jack Staver. He's the one who we're referring to and talking about. Last week, he brought a little camera and a little tripod, a camera pole, really, to record the Rules Committee in the Senate. And he was blocked from doing it. Again, the question is, why would you want to look as if you have something to hide?
Well, yeah, I mean, the response to this has not been one that most of us around this table would support. Democrats in general, and as far as I know, many Republicans that I know are all about transparency. I mean, you want to open government up to people. You want them to become involved. And, you know, not everybody who watches the Georgia legislature or, you know, paid hacks or professionals. There are people who are engaged in this process, particularly on certain bills. There's no reason not to put this stuff up. And certainly the way it's being handled is just drawing more attention to it. And to your point, yeah, it gives the illusion that there's something to hide. And that's what most people feel about government.
Now, I was talking to one kind of longtime staffer, former staffer in the Capitol, and who said there's a feeling in the Senate that they don't want to make it easier for lobbyists. They're already under enough pressure from lobbyists, and if a lobbyist can get on his desktop computer and watch it from his own office, then they're doing him a favor that they don't want to do. I think what happens is that this comes to an end as soon as we have a race for lieutenant governor in which one of the candidates say, I want a camera in every committee room. When that happens, it'll stop.
You know, Jim, your comment about lobbyists reminds me there's a history behind trying to limit access to committee meetings, especially among lobbyists. I recall when the House Rules Committee, which of course is the committee on the House side, as it is on the Senate side, that determines what makes it to the floor and what doesn't. Bills live and die in the Rules Committee. They used to, when Representative Bill Lee of Clayton County was chairman, they met in one of the smallest meeting rooms in the Capitol building, and they did it intentionally because they didn't want a crowded room with lots of lobbyists weighing in, right?
Right. I'm trying to remember which room was that because I was
It was a room, like one of those half-floor rooms. It was
in the mezzanine, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I do want to say this. There is a downside to the increasing ease with which you can communicate with your legislators. And that downside has come in the volume of email that makes the legislative email system virtually impossible to use. When I first started out, most constituent correspondence came in the old-fashioned way with a stamp on it, and you really could respond to most of it in a relatively timely manner. And then the fax machines got to where they were running 24 hours a day, spitting out copies of the same stuff. Now the deluge of email means that nobody almost gets responded to. And I am all for the public's right to communicate with their legislators. I'm all for their right to be able to see everything. But it does become a problem when there's too much discussion over every single little word that's spoken in a committee meeting.
Well, I do have two thoughts about that. Number one, not for lobbyists now, but for citizens, it seems to me one of the sure ways for people to lose interest in watching committee meetings, for those of us who've sat in many of them and have gone on endlessly, is to broadcast them, and people will see how quickly they don't want to pay attention.
I think you could probably kill the pharmaceutical business if you showed these things at 11 p.m. I mean, it is a sure snooze fest.
But just to put a period on this part of the conversation, because nothing is likely to change, right? As far as we know, Jim, nobody's moving to open up for access for citizens.
No, wait for the 2018 campaign.
Okay, I think that's important. It just strikes me that the reason this conversation, and I think the reason it's on the front page of your newspaper this morning, among other things, is living in an era where people have told Washington they are tired of being ignored, being disregarded, of not having access to the leadership. This just strikes me as a wrong note to sound.
That's right. And I know we're going to talk a little bit more about the budget, but I want to lose a thread that that Todd brought up, which is resources in the budget. I mean, let's be fair. It's difficult on days to get an internet signal at the Capitol. Many of the reporters who are down there bring their own hotspots.
Amen.
Yeah, their own hotspots. They have to use their own resources in order to get that signal. So I do think that there has to be a priority set about technology and resources. I also hope that that will come out of the 18 governor's race, but the upgrades and things that we need, because what Todd said is accurate. You have to have staff that are able to go around to the different rooms and be able to tape this sort of stuff. So I think there's the political side of it, and I also think for truly there is a resource issue with money and technology.
Okay.
And I would say that some of these issues, particularly with taping Senate committee hearings, really just they exacerbate some underlying personal issues among
folks. Right. Okay. Let's talk about the budget for a couple minutes. It's working its way through the legislature, Jim. The big budget, the 2018 fiscal
$25 billion.
$25 billion, the biggest budget we've ever seen. But that's not, we're not surprised by that, are we?
No. This is relatively concurrent with the growth in population.
Right. Exactly. There's a sense that there are a couple of big tax breaks that are reflected in this budget. Liz, one of them would give owners of big boats, I mean, boats that need, where you want like $500,000 of repair or retrofitting and above, a big tax break on the theory by the sponsors that this would encourage more boat repair businesses to open in the state. Yeah?
Yeah. I'm back here for 2 seconds, Bill. You want to wind me up already on what I think spending priorities are in the state. Yeah. I mean, that's a problem. The Delta thing is a problem.
Describe what the Delta thing is.
The Delta thing is this tax break that we continue to give Delta on its fuel, tax break on the fuel.
Which was rescinded. Three years ago.
They finally did the right thing and rescinded it. People may or may not know that originally when the economy started to tank, Delta was having some problems. The legislature stepped in and provided this tax break for Delta during that period. And, you know, for whatever you want to call it, I call it corporate welfare. And they kept coming back and back and back. And then finally the legislature said, fine, that's enough. I think the numbers that I saw, that we all saw, Delta's posting something like a $4.4 billion profit, and then they're back for another tax break. The boats are another tax break, and yet we say we don't have the money to fully fund increases for state workers, or we don't have enough money for education. And I would posit that it is about setting priorities.
Todd, Representative John Carson from up Marietta Way says that as far as he's concerned, the Delta bill is about creating jobs. Is there a point there? Do these both the boat repair bill, encouraging boat repair businesses to come into the state, and the Delta bill, do Republicans make a good argument on this?
Well, I want to say that the boat repair bill has been talked about in terms of mega yachts.
Right.
But I think what it really is about is the container ships that call on the ports at Brunswick and Savannah, because you know, I think it has to be a 500. Is it 500,000 or more?
It's 500,000. Yeah.
And those are the kind of repairs that get done on container ships. That is one of Georgia's growing industries. Is the shipping industry. A couple years back, there were some tax breaks given. I believe it was on parts for Gulfstream to do repairs in the Savannah area. And yeah, most folks who ride around on Gulfstreams are millionaires or billionaires, but it provides a lot of good jobs. Some folks think that providing jobs through spending government money is not a good thing. And if that's your philosophy, none of these things are going to make you very happy. But you know, we have had some success with targeted tax incentives, specifically looking at the motion picture industry.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing, Bill, about HB 145. That's the Delta bill.
Yeah.
There's an interesting bit of math here. It's calculated on the fact that a jet will burn 45% of its fuel upon takeoff. And so what it does, it allows a sales tax exemption on 45% of the fuel loaded into a jet going out of state.
So the other bill that the other price tag that's caught a lot of attention is for up in Hall County, Jim, the governor's home county. There's a proposal in the budget, there's a line in the budget, rather, calling for $73 million in additional spending to move technical college, I'm sorry.
Lanier Tech,
from one part of Hall County to another part of Hall County, and it's part of a over $100 million in total appropriated for this. And, you know, anytime a governor or a House Speaker, any leader, we see a measure that benefits to a great extent their own home county, it does send up a flag.
I can pick out every hall of worship for every past governor we've had in the last 30 years. Let me see. There's Zell Miller had the golf course up in North Georgia.
We had Go Fish.
Roy Barnes had the amphitheater in Mapleton.
Yep. That's right.
I'm blanking on some of the others.
It might be easier just to go ahead and put a line in the budget that says, here's your prize for being governor, and call it that. At least that would be transparent and people would know.
Todd says, I'm not going there.
No, he's not going. He's got too much to lose here.
So, Liz, overall, when you look, what's the general Democratic take on this budget? What's your bottom line Democratic response to a bill that's being controlled pretty much by Republican lawmakers?
Yeah, I mean, Jim said earlier that this is not out of line with where we have been going with the state. We're keeping an eye on everything. Obviously, we do not have the votes to control the budget, and we certainly will be talking about some of the things that are important to us and priorities when the bill makes its way over to the Senate as it's headed now.
Now, House Democrats have got a couple items in there, and one is $600 million for funding six staffers for the GBI to process rape kits. That is Scott Holcomb's bill, and he formed a very good alliance with Republican lawmakers on that side of the House. And then you've got $14.9 million that Stacey Abrams, House Minority Leader, wanted for kinship care. For child care, to encourage child care by family members, not in the immediate family, I suppose, you know, maybe grandmothers and such, grandfathers. And that's kind of reflective of the fact that you've got some issues coming up real quickly. Casino gambling comes to mind, where you're going to have some very unusual bipartisan coalitions.
Interesting. The spending bill this year also calls for big increases for state law enforcement. I'm not sure, Liz, there are going to be a lot of arguments about wanting to give law enforcement officers in the state competitive salaries, will there?
No. We're actually very happy to see that and some of the other increases in there as well. We would, in fact, like to see more than a 2% increase for other
state employees.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's been very meager for them over the past few years. I think last year it was 1%. The year before that, maybe it was 2 and 1. I mean, these folks, just to cap, you know, even just cost of living, they're not keeping pace with. So we would like to see more of that.
And it's not just raises for law enforcement that's getting some of the money. They're going to build a new coastal regional crime lab. One of the things that with the rape kits and with all other sorts of crimes that we've seen over the years is serious backlogs in anything requiring forensic analysis by the GBI. And so some money is going to flow that way. The problem for anybody with this kind of a budget, but specifically for Republicans, is we have had 8 to 10 years of declining budgets and pent up pressures for relief with money somewhere. And the hard part is, in a naturally rising economy, to think 10 years or 20 or 30 years down the road of starting this project, is it going to make sense? Are we going to be able to cut it someday if we need to?
One other quick item on the budget, and then let's move on. I was struck by the fact that we've got about $1 billion in bonded indebtedness built into this budget. And all I could think about is a guy who was around there for a long time is Tom Murphy would be turning over in his grave if he thought we were going to borrow that much money. And the question is it a good idea to this day?
Well, I mean, look at the interest rates. You know, you're borrowing money and having to pay hardly anything for it. So you've got the bean counters in the state capitol say, why not?
I think that's right. And I would say two things about the budget that we need to keep an eye on. And Democrats are going to watch that. But, you know, the analogy of, you know, you've got $45,000 in family income and you have $11,000 worth of debt, which would be about the figures that you'd use for a $45 billion budget. That's not awful.
Okay.
So, and the other thing I would like to say, though, is that a large part of what Todd just brought up in terms of the money we have available, the $92 million is from a settlement with Tenet. So all of the things that we're doing, these ongoing, we have to keep ongoing raises and such, we have to keep an eye on that. Are we going to be able to make that up in subsequent years?
Explain what that settlement was.
So I don't know all the ins and outs
right,
of the settlement,
fine,
but there was a $92 million settlement against Tenet hospitals that took place. Tenet is no longer operating in Georgia as a result of it. But that is a plug to in a positive way towards the budget. But
it's free money.
It's free money. And they're doing good things with it, things that we're not complaining about, the raises and such. But remember that $92 million isn't going to be there necessarily
next year.
Right. So you want to shore up projects that, you know, to Todd's point, you know, if you're going to look at something long term, you know, how are you going to fund it in that way?
Tell you what, we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, Jim, I do want to talk a little bit about Sally Yates. She is the buzz in Democratic Party circles right now. And you wrote a really good column about her yesterday. As we go to our first break, everybody knows Hamilton, the musical, by now. George Washington is a major character in Hamilton. So as we go to the break, let's just listen to a little of George Washington's entrance into Hamilton.
Here he comes.
Here comes the general.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Here comes the general.
The moment you've been waiting for.
Here comes the general.
The pride of Mount Vernon.
Here comes the general.
George Washington.
We are outgunned. Outmanned.
On the next Fresh Air, Presidential Secrecy and Transparency. We'll talk with writer Mary Graham, author of the new book Presidential Secrets, The Use and Abuse of Hidden Power. Graham is the co-founder of the Transparency Policy Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She'll talk about historical presidential secrets and what she describes as President Trump's lack of transparency. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Populism, yeah, yeah! Populism, yeah!
All right, so Populism is a song from a musical called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which played at the New York Public Theater for a long time, went to Broadway for a while. And I thought it was particularly apropos right now, Jim Galloway, because we're talking about a president who seems to be a populist, at least certainly in by definition.
This is the portrait that hangs in every picture of Donald Trump that we see from the White House.
That's exactly right. That's a fun score, by the way. So, Jim, you wrote a piece, a column in yesterday's paper about Democrats hoping that Sally Yates, fired by Donald Trump because she refused to carry out his travel ban, she told her lawyers not to defend it. And then subsequently we learned that she had also told him that his national security advisor may be in violation of federal law. And now she's kind of back in Atlanta, and people want her to run.
Absolutely. I mean, Georgia Democrats are just absolutely thirsty for someone who they think might be able to get those lost white voters back in the fold. But the Sunday column, I was hoping I didn't want to put it out of reach, but I just wanted to cool down the tempers a little bit on the choices that Ms. Yates faces. It was one thing when she had when she got fired by Donald Trump for telling Justice Department lawyers not to defend the immigration executive order, but then when the Michael Flynn news surfaced, and which actually happened before the travel ban order, but didn't come to light until after Sally Yates had left. When that happened, I think the dynamic changed a little bit, because what you have now, you have Sally Yates, who is the acting Attorney General of the United States, is now that kind of sole transition figure between the Obama administration and the new Trump administration, and it puts her in a very delicate situation when you think you've got four U.S. Senate committees possibly holding investigations, a House Intelligence Committee possibly holding an investigation, maybe John McCain is still holding out the prospect of a bipartisan select commission.
Yeah, and suddenly Sally Yates' motivations to test in her testimony, were she to be giving us hints she was going to be a Democratic candidate for governor, it throws that into a very different light.
Right, right.
It becomes political.
The optics change drastically.
There. Liz, is Jim right, though? Everybody, Democrats really think Sally Yates, you should be talking her into running?
Well, I will say this. She's obviously an incredibly intelligent person with a very distinguished career. And if she makes any sort of noise that she wants to run, I think she will be given more than a serious look. I mean, there obviously had some other people who have talked about running in 18, and I think we just need to wait and see who those people are going to be. I mean, we'll know by the end of this year, maybe by the fall, of who's in.
Todd, I have said all along here that, first of all, I don't see it as part of who Sally Yates is. She's such a circumspect person. She keeps her own counsel. Her family background, she's got tremendous political lineage. But I just, two things on that. Number one, I just find it hard to see her out in that kind of public arena. And two, I don't know that she'd have a hard time. She could win a Democratic primary, maybe, but I don't know about a general election.
Well, especially if the prospect is of having a general election while President Trump is furiously tweeting out how horrible a person you are every time right. It crosses his mind. I think Uncle Buddy Darden said it well in Politico and I'm paraphrasing, I think he said it in a way more kind to his own folks, but it sort of represents the desperation of some within the Democratic Party of Georgia that they'll sort of glom onto any glimmer of hope. And like you, she looks a lot more like a career public servant.
Yeah.
Who she's had notoriety thrust on her through the series of corruption trials that she held, through this latest one. I've never seen her seek the spotlight in a political sense.
I love that description. Right, a public servant rather than an elected official.
And if I had to guess, and that's all I'm doing right
sure.
now, is I'm guessing on what Sally Yates' lifelong ambition has been. It's been to become the real U.S. Attorney General of the United States and not the governor of Georgia.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to watch it. It's fascinating. I thought what was important about your column yesterday was not only talking about the thirst that some Democrats have to get her into the race, but also you helped us see what role she is likely to play in the months ahead as all these investigations on the Hill take place. She's going to be a key player. She's going to be called in every one of those investigations.
Right. And remember, if she's a candidate for governor when those things happen, then We've seen congressional investigations weaponized against political candidates.
All right,
before.
We'll watch it. Todd Ream, give us a quick take on what's happening with the 6th district race. We now know that Betty Price, a wife of Tom Price, a state rep, is not going to run after all. But Karen Handel's in it strong. We've got 18 candidates? I think 11 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 3 independents, something like that?
So several weeks ago, maybe months ago, my fear was that the Democratic Party would unite behind a single candidate and the Republicans would split the vote six or seven ways. I think there's less chance of the Democratic Party uniting on their own terms, but they do have what appears to be a strong candidate. What I was surprised was the sheer number of candidates. I was thinking we initially had a burst of a lot of House members and senators. It looked like there were going to be 50 special elections by the time everybody tried to move up or move out. And then all of that died off. Some of the House members who had announced for it said they were just kidding or whatever. But we have all these folks out there who want to be the everyman who gets to Washington, the business guy who gets there. And it's just going to be backbreaking for the mail carriers in my area. The mass media are certainly going to make a mint. And I can think of I can think of a friend of mine who owns a mail house up in Kennesaw who's going to be pumping out a lot of these mail pieces.
So we've talked on the show several times now about the fact this is going to be a jungle primary, which means the top two vote getters, regardless of party affiliation, will face off in a runoff. And there's certainly going to be a runoff. But what kind of startles me in hearing you all talk about this before the show went on the air is predictions about what percentage of the vote you might need to get into that runoff.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, somewhere between 9 to 12% could get you in.
Good Lord.
Now, and we will be we could be judging the top two berths by a matter of tenths or hundreds of points. Mm-hmm. Percentage points. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Dan.
And you called it a jungle primary. I think you meant to say clown car primary. Yeah, well, because we stuffed them all into one vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Liz? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, I mean, it's not only that low number, but it's also a special election, which tends to drive way smaller numbers to begin with.
Which strikes me as one reason that the national media, which has really seized on this race as an early bellwether of Trump's popularity in a district that he barely won, may be really misplaced.
No, I don't think it's miscalculated.
It's a whole different voting universe.
I think it's miscalculated. I think what you're going to have is a very, very interesting conversation among Republicans on how to talk about Donald Trump.
I think
and
that's
what he's
true.
Doing.
Yeah. But the outcome, because we can in no way compare the turnout in a presidential race to what we're going to see in a special election. But yes, I think Jim's point is really well made.
Yeah.
We're going to see how Republicans position themselves in regard to the president.
Just this morning, we had a report that an email house, some sort of PAC, was sending
Save
out emails.
Save America PAC, I think it is.
Yeah, sending out emails, fundraising, it said, on behalf of Karen Handel. And it said she was going to ban all Muslim immigration.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that's not true.
She's disavowed that entirely.
It was a bogus email, but that's kind of the discussion that we're going to be headed for.
And frankly, it's if you wanted to try to harm a Republican candidate in this district, you might say something like that, because this is a district that Marco Rubio ran the table in most of it. But I think we're going to see a lot of the Washington media coming down here to do drive-by pieces on it. But ultimately, you can't change the numbers of a district that I suspect when everything is settled, we'll have a double-digit win, maybe 20 points
All
or
right.
more for a Republican.
Well, it's going to be plenty for us to talk about between now and that April primary date. Look, we've got to get a second break in right now. But on the phone with us, we're going to talk to him after a pretty short break, is Brandon Rodinghaus, who is the co-author and worked on a study, a survey of political scientists, American political scientists. It's an annual survey of how do they rank the most successful to the least successful. And I think on President's Day, he is the perfect person to be talking to. Before we do that, let's take a very quick break. As we continue our musical tribute to presidents, this was from everybody's favorite musical, Annie.
There's Bobby
and Jackie
and Jack and myriads more in the back. There's Ethel and Teddy and Pat.
All right, we're going to reset that. This is from a musical called Merrily We Roll Along, and it is a song about the Kennedys.
And Jackie.
And Jack. And Miri, it's more in the back. There's Ethel and Teddy and Pat alone.
Plus Eunice.
And Peter.
And Jean.
And Joan.
And what's his name?
Stephen.
And hold the phone, the one in the army.
One in the army?
Captain Major.
Sergeant.
That's it, so many cards in the pack. You'll want to know how to keep track. Well, one is good looking and young and rich. Well, one is good looking and young and rich. The rest are good looking and young and rich.
I'm Russ Bellin, Vice President of Broadway in Atlanta. Broadway in Atlanta is the premier presenter of national touring Broadway, and we host over 250,000 guests annually at the Fox Theater. Broadway in Atlanta underwrites with GPB because we are big supporters of the arts, and we believe the listeners of GPB do as well. Subscribers will come up and thank us for supporting the local GPB station.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
Mr. Nixon plays the piano, see, anyhow. I heard some time ago from a friend of his that he wrote a selection, wrote a composition. And we had, would you bring a piano out here if we can do this? We had Mrs. Nixon, Pat, had a tape recorder going one afternoon, and she quietly said to Mr. Nixon, why don't you play an old piece? And she recorded it. Now, that's okay. Mr. Nixon is aware of that. This is not what you call one of those trick surprises.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Todd Rehm, Liz Flowers, and Jim Galloway. That is a really rare piece of sound. That was an appearance that Richard Nixon made in March of 1963 on the Jack Parr Tonight Show. And one of the reasons I played that, Jim, is it's really ironic and sort of prescient that Parr talks about this little secret recording that Mrs. Nixon made.
You almost expected to hear him say Rosemary.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of presidents of the United States, we welcome now by telephone Brandon Rodinghaus, who is a political science professor at the University of Houston, but you also work on the annual survey of political scientists who look at their latest rankings every year on the top presidents. Is that a fair way to say it?
I do. Afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. While we're talking about him, where does Richard Nixon show up in your polling this year? Do you remember off the top of your head?
You know, Nixon tends to be a little lower, a little of the unpleasantness associated with Watergate tends to drag his numbers down. The irony is that even though, you know, Watergate tended to hurt him, strong presidents like Nixon, who really tried to centralize power in the office, did tend to do better. So it shows you that a couple of big slip-ups are going to be the thing that's going to drag your rankings way down.
That's really interesting. So were there any, you know, when we look over the rankings among the political scientists who weighed in on this survey, some of them aren't surprised. I mean, Lincoln on top, Washington, right. FDR. Are there any in this survey this year that where there's movement that surprised you at all?
I would say that the one that was surprising was that George W. Bush ended up a little lower. Typically, modern presidents tend to appear in at least in the top 20. I mean, he didn't. And this took place, the polling took place fairly close after some of the feelings were still pretty hot about President Bush. And so that tended to, I think, compromise some of his ability to be able to move up the chain. But also surprising, frankly, was President Obama ends up being pretty high on that list. And given that, other questions we asked about polarization and which presidents were the most polarizing, the fact that Obama was the most polarizing, second only to President Bush, and that he ended up in the top 20 was pretty remarkable.
Eisenhower makes the top 10. That surprises me a little bit.
Yeah, but I will tell you what, if you can connect it to what we just went through, which was basically we went through a nostalgia campaign where we were trying to make America great again. And what period were most people pointing to? They were pointing to the 50s.
Brandon, what are your thoughts?
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, presidents tend to do well when they've got peace and prosperity, and if you can make that happen, then you're going to get yourself on Mount Rushmore. I'll say this, too, that Eisenhower-specific rankings, we asked people subsequently to their overall ranking how they felt about the presidents in terms of specific categories. Eisenhower ranks the highest of all among military credibility and amongst diplomatic credibility, and he comes in only like third or fourth in what we call champion of the people. So he scores high on several sub-dimensions that, you know, overall we don't think of Eisenhower as being this sort of charismatic leader in the model of, you know, TR or, you know, of an Abraham Lincoln. But he scores well on the specific categories people care about that in terms of rankings.
He would have made a great national security advisor in this Trump administration. It's too bad he's not around, right? What about the fact that your survey shows that among the most overrated presidents, John F. Kennedy registers high? I mean, we know the mystique of John Kennedy, but you're dealing with people who work in the profession and probably have a more specific understanding of what he did or did not accomplish during his time in office, yes?
I think that's fair. And part of the issue with President Kennedy was that I think that the promise didn't always necessarily translate into the practice. And so a lot of people looked at the mystique that Kennedy brought to the office and didn't see the results.
So JFK would be the backswing and Johnson would be the follow through.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right. And so Johnson gets some credit for being, you know, kind of legislative, his legislative prowess. But I think a lot of people thought Kennedy was sort of overblown. The same is true of Andrew Jackson. Frankly, a lot of presidents who got a lot of attention the last 5 or 6 years in terms of big biographies or in terms of documentaries tended to be thought of as being overhyped. And looking into the details of like what specific presidents like Madison or Wilson did, I think gave people a little bit more clarity as to what their value was.
Who are the worst? I know James Buchanan is at the very bottom of your list, yes?
Yeah, we're not going to make a monument to these folks. James Buchanan at the very bottom for his inability to kind of unify the country after the Civil War, Harding with multiple scandals. Andrew Johnson, I think, in part because of the difficulties during Reconstruction, ended up being pretty low on that list.
All right. Todd Rehm, if you had to rank him, there's always this wonderful Washington-Lincoln back-and-forth argument, but just talk about it from your point of view.
I've been waiting for this. I've been waiting for this since yesterday, because yesterday was the 75th anniversary of Roosevelt signing Executive Order 9066, which led to the eventual internment of people for simply who had Japanese names.
Right.
I think he deserves to be at the absolute bottom of the list.
Wow.
I'm hard pressed to think of a worse thing that a president has done in the last 100 years.
Brandon, that's really an interesting way of viewing. That's an interesting lens to put FDR's entire presidency in.
That's right. And then the longer you're president, typically the more chances you have to be able to make enemies and make mistakes. Obviously FDR was in office for longer than most. There's a sort of promise and myth in the presidency that presidents can do great things, but the details are really in the fine points. And I think that it's a good point to say that some of these things are extreme enough that it should prohibit them from being thought of as the great presidents. I'll say this, though. We asked people a question about who should be the next president on Mount Rushmore, the next four. FDR was the number one choice. 64% of people chose FDR, followed by Reagan, and then Eisenhower, and then Andrew Jackson.
You know, Liz, one of the interesting things to me always is, in terms of FDR and his popularity, just thinking about it from the Georgia lens, so much of what FDR went into office and his visionary thinking happened because of the months he spent driving around the countryside down there in South Georgia by what is now the Little White House, or what became the Little White House, the rural electrification project, among many other things, were inspired by his trips through Georgia.
Oh yeah, you're talking to somebody here who grew up along Roosevelt Highway.
Yeah,
down in South Atlanta.
Speaking of Georgia, where's Carter, Brandon?
You know, Jimmy Carter, oddly enough, ends up being pretty low on the list, which is again surprising since most modern presidents tended to appear fairly high on that list. Carter's in the middle. He's ranked 26, and I think there's a tremendous amount of misunderstanding about how presidents function and the sort of ability of presidents to get things done. We see even today Donald Trump, who's got unified government, Carter had the same thing. Getting things done is not easy, even if you're got, you know, most of the, you know, Congress on your side. So Carter ends up being pretty middle of the pack on our rankings.
You know, it's interesting, Liz. We read a an excerpt from a Newsweek article the other day about new president, outsider and never expected to win, comes to Washington, doesn't have any skills dealing with Washington politics, how chaotic the first months are. And it wasn't about Donald Trump. It was about Jimmy Carter.
he had a rough start.
Yeah, it was a 1973 Newsweek article. Brandon, if you had to pick, where do you personally weigh in on the, say, the top three?
My sort of criteria is fairly direct, and that is, did you leave the office stronger than when you left it? And there are only a handful of presidents can really do that. And this, frankly, also removes presidents whose only contribution was having won a war, which I think is clearly what a lot of people think of. So when we think about the broadening of the office, the growth of the authority of the office, I think about Lincoln and Washington, FDR, and probably beyond that, I'm going to say Nixon. And this is an unpopular choice because Watergate obviously tends to put a pall over things. But Nixon's ability to be able to expand the office and to be able to create a new White House that can govern a modern era was something that then allowed for subsequent presidents, including Ronald Reagan.
Jim Galloway.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, Richard Nixon was the fellow who created the EPA that we're trying to get rid of right now.
That's right. Brandon, we want to thank you for joining us for a few minutes to share your survey with us. It's really interesting on this President's Day to get a glimpse of how people in your profession feel about the success or failures of various presidents. So thanks very much for being with us. Are you down there at University of Houston right now?
I am, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and we appreciate your time.
It was fun. Thanks again.
Bye-bye. So we've only got a few minutes left. Are any of you readers, Jim, you read presidential biographies.
Oh, absolutely.
So with the few minutes we have remaining, you know, we're going to publish on the Political Rewind website today in the blog an article from the New York Times about the 17 best presidential biographies. But I want to know yours.
Okay. All right. My favorite, and you know, it changes as you go along. My current favorite right now is about James Garfield, Candace Willard, Millard, Destiny of a Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President.
It is. I'm so glad you said it. I wasn't even thinking about it. That's a riveting book.
It is. And it's a fairly slim volume that you can get through it maybe in two or three nights. But it focuses on James Garfield as kind of the lost presidency. He was the fellow who might have turned around Reconstruction in the South so that it would be it might have become something other than Jim Crow.
But it also deals with the incredible mental health issues that threaded their way through that entire
administration. And you know, and we cite James Garfield as one of our assassinated presidents, but really he died of medical incompetence.
Yes, right. That's exactly right. And the book does talk about that in great detail. Great choice. Todd, do you have a favorite?
My favorite are the Robert A. Cairo
the LBJ
series.
Books.
And really, my preference is for the legislative years.
Master of the Senate
because,
is a brilliant
well,
book.
And even before that, when LBJ was an intern down in the basement of the Capitol, rounding up all the other interns to try to get something done. It's a fascinating look at legislative leadership.
Liz?
So I think my favorite, to Jim's point right now anyway, remains Team of Rivals.
Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Yeah, and I will disclose that in my home office I have a picture of Abe Lincoln with an Obama button on his lapel. gives away my favorites. But the reason I like that book and the reason actually those two are right now my favorite presidents, if I had to choose, is because I liked how they chose to confront their adversaries and bring them in and make them a part of the team. And I actually think that's really relevant with this current administration that we have with Donald Trump. Instead of, you know, pushing away and making enemies and confronting and further dividing, I like the idea of politics as compromise.
So I think that's, you know, Team of Rivals would be on a lot of people's lists. I pick, and if you're talking Doris Kearns Goodwin, No Ordinary Time, mm-hmm. which is a look at Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt during the war years and delves very deeply, not only into the policy decisions, the history of what was happening to the country, but also into the personal interactions and relationships between Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt in a really compelling way. It's a fascinating book. But if I had to pick a number one, Jim, Ron Chernow, you know, of course, everybody talk about how oh, sure. Lin-Manuel Miranda went off and read Hamilton by Chernow and came back and wrote the musical. But his biography of George Washington, I think, one of the most extraordinary books because he makes him feel like a real human being.
And he kind of establishes Washington yet again as kind of that fundamental step that we needed to take at the outset of giving up power, of walking away from authority.
I think that's absolutely
right. But I think
right.
that's his writing style because I actually am reading Hamilton now. Couldn't resist the temptation with all of the buzz, and I mean it reads as close to a political thriller as something can when it's actually based on fact. And so I mean I think that says a lot about the writer as well as the actual presidencies that we're talking about.
All right. Well, we're going to publish as I said, on our blog at Political Rewind, the list. It includes books like John Meacham's book on Andrew Jackson, a terrific biography, and many others. It's got the top seven, or what they pick is their favorite 17, and we'll put it up there. We're also going to post the Washington Post article that our guest Brandon Rodinghouse wrote for the Post about the rankings of American president. So it's President's Day, and I think a great way to end this show today is to say that no matter our politics today, when we look back in the history of presidents, Jim, we realize that there are some tales of incredible heroism, of courage, of great success and failure. The history of America, you can really play out in terms of one president after the other, I think.
And you have to wonder whether it cuts to the quick of the old argument. Does the president make the history, or does the history make the president?
Exactly. A great way to end the show today. And we'll watch that with Donald Trump in the months and years ahead. Todd Rehm, Liz Flowers, Jim Galloway, really great to have you all here today. Thanks for being with us. Remember, if you cannot be with us when we're on the radio, you can always subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. All of our shows are archived on our website at gpbnews.org, so you can find us there as well. We're going to be back on Wednesday with a really good panel. Greg Bluestein of the AJC will be here. So will Republican strategist Loretta Lepore, former WSB-TV political reporter Lori Geary will be with us that day, and we're looking forward to seeing her. And Patricia Murphy, columnist for The Daily Beast and The Hill, will be with us. So that's 2 o'clock Wednesday afternoon, and then Friday we're going to be doing a show live from the Georgia Bar Association, the state's bar media conference, a conference of judges, attorneys, journalists, all talking about issues that matter to them. We're going to be doing our show live in front of that audience. So join us all week for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Have a great day.